Roundup Weed Killer. Monsanto says it's safe enough to drink. But is it?
He believed Roundup to be as safe as table salt, right? Safe enough to drink. And he would apply it himself from a backpack applicator around his farm. And the dog would romp with him, you know, through the fields. And the dog came down with lymphoma after several years of Jack's use of Roundup. And then Jack himself came down with non-Hodgkin lymphoma. And he died.
That's Carrie Gillum. We talk with her about her book, Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. Then, it's not all bad news on the pesticide front. We talk with Philip Ackerman Leist about the remarkable story of a town that organized and won the right to be pesticide-free. His book is A Precautionary Tale, How One Small Town Banned Pesticides, Preserved Its Food Heritage, and Inspired a Movement. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. It's the pesticide on our dinner plates, a chemical so pervasive it's in the air we breathe, our water, our soil, and even our own bodies. It's glyphosate, a.k.a. Roundup, made by Monsanto, and it's the world's most popular weed killer. For decades, glyphosate has been touted as safe enough to drink, but emerging evidence shows just the opposite, tying the chemical to cancers and a host of other health threats. In her book, Whitewash, journalist Carrie Gillum goes in depth to uncover one of the most controversial stories in the history of food and agriculture. She met farm families devastated by cancers they linked to the chemical. She talked to scientists whose reputations have been smeared when they published research that went against Monsanto. She showed how regulators have been captured by corporate interests. And Gillum reveals secret industry efforts to manipulate public opinion. It all started 20 years ago when Carrie Gillum was tasked by Reuters to move to the Midwest as an agriculture reporter. Monsanto had just introduced GMO crops designed to work with Roundup, the so-called Roundup Ready crops. Her two decades of reporting have resulted in a story of power, politics, and the deadly consequences of putting corporate interests ahead of public safety. Her book is Whitewash. Carrie Gillum is a veteran journalist with more than 25 years' experience in the news industry covering corporate America. She was a former senior correspondent for Reuters International and is currently research director for the nonprofit U.S. Right to Know. Well, Carrie Gillum, welcome to Writer's Voice. So your book is about Monsanto's blockbuster herbicide glyphosate, a.k.a. Roundup. You write that the flood across our landscape of this chemical is a health and environmental calamity. How is glyphosate used, and how prevalent is its use?
So glyphosate is ubiquitous in our world today. Glyphosate is used by, you know, homeowners in their lawns and gardens. It's used by golf course operators to keep the courses neat and clean. It's used on children's playgrounds, city parks. It's used in forestry management, and it's used by farmers, you know, in the production of our food. It's used in conjunction with more than 70 different food crops being grown around the United States. It's the most widely used agrochemical in the world. We've gone from about 40 million pounds a year in the United States in the 90s to about 300 million pounds a year now used by farmers. And it's leaving residues in our foods. It's been found in, you know, a whole array of food products, baby oatmeal even, you know, oatmeal that you buy off the store shelves, and bread products. It's found in bottled water. You know, it's in our drinking water. It's in our surface waters. And it's in our own bodies. If you have your urine tested, you will probably have traces of glyphosate in your body. It's something that's almost impossible for us to escape.
Well, Monsanto has touted glyphosate as less toxic than aspirin, although aspirin actually can be pretty toxic, but they almost implied safe enough to drink. Talk about the multiple effects on health that you outline in this book.
So as glyphosate use has grown over the years, and as it's become, you know, so pervasive, scientists around the world obviously have worked to study its impacts on humans and on the environment. There are countless studies, toxicology studies, epidemiology that's been done that show harmful impacts. And, you know, some of those are link it to cancer, non-Hodgkin lymphoma in particular. There was a study out by some of our own government scientists that came out just in November that linked it to acute myeloid leukemia. It's been linked to kidney disease and liver problems. There's a whole array of concerns pertaining to how this chemical impacts human health. And then, of course, environmentally, the impacts, the detrimental impacts, have been pretty well documented. There's a whole host of those concerns as well. But Monsanto, it's not surprising, I suppose, they make many billions of dollars a year off of this chemical, and they have worked really hard to try to suppress the evidence of harm and to try to discredit and harass scientists and journalists and pretty much anybody who, you know, raises a hand and says, "Hey, what about this? What about this concern?" They're working really hard to hide the negative effects.
Right. You outline that pretty much in detail in this book, Whitewash, The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. But before we get to some of those ways that they combat, you know, kind of the glyphosate denial industry, we could call it, tell us about the case of Jack McCall.
Oh, such a sad story. So sad. Jack and Terry McCall have this beautiful farm in Cambria, California, where they have grown, you know, for years, citrus fruits and avocados, and raise their children, you know, and it's just a beautiful place, and it almost looks like an idyllic sort of lifestyle. Jack only used Roundup. He wanted his fruits and avocados to be very healthy and nutritious, and he sold them at local farmers markets and didn't like pesticides, but he believed Roundup to be as safe as table salt, right? Safe enough to drink, and he would apply it himself from a backpack applicator around his farm, and the dog would romp with him, you know, through the fields. And the dog came down with lymphoma after several years of Jack's use of Roundup, and then Jack himself came down with non-Hodgkin lymphoma, and he died a really horrible death. That the treatments didn't work, and he died just the day after Christmas in 2015, and was one of the first plaintiffs in what is now sort of nationwide mass litigation against Monsanto, alleging that Roundup caused non-Hodgkin lymphoma in all of these plaintiffs or in their loved ones. And there are about 3,500 plaintiffs right now. Terry McCall is one of them involved in this litigation, and it's ongoing both in federal court and in state courts around the United States.
So this is the same suit, class action suit, in both federal and state courts?
Right. Well, and it technically, it's not considered class action. It's considered multi-district litigation, which probably is not an important distinction to your listeners, but it is a distinction nonetheless. And yeah, so these lawsuits are moving forward on two fronts, both federal and state. And we actually have a trial that will be starting, the very first trial in June this summer.
Well, now I know, I understand that class action suits have been made much more difficult, I believe, in the last year by the Trump administration. Does this mean that because this is not theoretically a class action suit, that it can go ahead more easily?
Well, so far, yes, they are moving forward. Those efforts to try to stifle class actions are not applying to this. And what this essentially means is that these cases are moving forward.
So now, it's not just glyphosate. I think one of the important points that you make in the book is that in the real world, chemicals don't appear isolated. They appear in formulations with other chemicals. So talk about, what are the other chemicals that are mixed with glyphosate that also are creating health issues and potentiating the harm?
Yeah, and that's really something that consumers are not aware of. When the EPA and regulators around the world, when they look at the safety or lack of these chemicals, they're looking at the chemicals in isolation. They're looking at safety data that's provided by the manufacturers, the people who make money off of it, of this particular chemical. So that's one problem right there, that they're relying on, you know, safety data that's provided by the very people who profit off of it. But the other big one is that they're looking at the chemicals by themselves. They're not looking at the formulated products that are actually sold, that you would actually go pick up off the store shelf and use. So in the case of Roundup, glyphosate has often been combined with something that we refer to as POEA, which is, if I can say it correctly, a polyethyloxidated talamine, but it's a surfactant chemical. And the researchers, independent researchers, have found that when you combine this in this formulated product, it's much more toxic than glyphosate by itself. So some of the health concerns are tied to this formulation. And of course, our regulators don't look at that and don't want to look at that. And this has been a flaw, you know, for decades in the system. Now, the EPA has been pressured to the extent that they have acknowledged that, you know, they need to start looking at this and have made some moves to perhaps start doing that in conjunction with our national toxicology program. But so far, that's not the way the world works when it comes to regulation of chemicals.
So did start this process of beginning to consider that before or after Scott Pruitt became the head of the EPA?
Well, they said that they were going to start doing this in 2016. So this would have been the fall of 2016, before the Trump administration took office. But CropLife International, which is the big lobbying arm for the chemical industry, was very upset about the idea of this formulated product testing and pushed back on it. And who knows where things stand right now. People aren't wanting to talk much about it.
Now, another issue is, you know, people say, well, okay, it's a pesticide, it's, you know, we don't eat it. But there is an issue around pesticide residues that the company has been very loath to give credence to.
Oh, my goodness, we do eat it. We consume every day, you know, dozens, if not hundreds, of different pesticide residues in our foods that we eat. Unless you're eating a strictly organic diet, you know, or growing your own food and not using pesticides, you're consuming these. And it's not a secret. The USDA and the FDA every year test thousands of food samples for pesticide residues, and they document those in giant reports that I have stacked in my desk, and you can get them as well. But they measure, because what our EPA does is they say that certain levels of these different pesticides are fine, are legally allowed or tolerated. They call them tolerances in our foods. And these are, you know, not just glyphosate, but all different insecticides, other herbicides, fungicides, you know, a whole array, hundreds of different pesticides that they allow in our food. And they simply measure our food. And if the levels are below the tolerance level, then our government says it's fine. Don't worry about it. It's safe to eat. If they're at higher levels than the tolerance, they're considered illegal and the government is supposed to take action. So, you know, what happens is on a strawberry, for instance, strawberry samples, there are often 20 or so different types of pesticide residues that you're consuming when you eat a bowl of strawberries. And even though the government continues to tell us, don't worry about it, many, many, many scientists around the world say, no, we need to be worried about this. This is a real problem. We haven't done sufficient testing. We don't know what this dietary exposure every day is doing to our children's health and to our own health.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Carrie Gillum about her book, Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. One of the foods that I was surprised to see is contaminated is honey. And when we say contaminated by glyphosate, could this be having an impact on bees? Could it be a factor in colony collapse disorder?
Well, that is certainly a possibility. Yeah, honey was surprising to me as well. And this came through documents I obtained from the Food and Drug Administration. They were starting to test some food samples for glyphosate. They hadn't done it in decades, even though they've tested for all sorts of other pesticides, never wanted to test for glyphosate residues, but started to do that, a little bit of that in 2016, and one of their chemists sampled honey, pulled honey samples from store shelves, including organic honey, and found glyphosate in every one of them at illegally high levels. And this, of course, is not because, you know, honey producers don't spray their beehives with glyphosate. It's because bees travel, you know, around farm fields and yards and gardens and go where bees want to go. And then they pick up this pesticide and then it's produced in their honey. And the revelations have triggered lawsuits now, and honey producers are, you know, all worried, and it's become a real problem to try to get pesticide-free honey. But of course, pesticides are one of the culprits, as you mentioned, in the demise of our bee population. And of course, bees are necessary to pollinate, you know, so much of our food supply. But pesticides are being shown and have been connected to, you know, disruption in the health of the honeybee. And we're seeing colony, you know, collapse, really, bee population decimated. So that, again, is a problem that, you know, goes back to our pervasive use of pesticides.
Now, the IARC, and you'll tell us who that is, deemed glyphosate a probable human carcinogen, and they didn't do that all that recently. It's been around for a while. What is the IARC, and how did this testing come about that came up with this result?
Well, the IARC, we call it IARC, is the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And this is part of the World Health Organization. It's their cancer research arm. And what they do is they convene on a regular basis the top cancer scientists from around the world, from many, many different countries, to come together and analyze research that has been done on different substances for which there is a carcinogenic concern. And they've done this, you know, for decades. They've looked at over 1,000 different substances, but they determined in 2014 that glyphosate was something that they should look at. And so they brought together these scientists, 17 of the top scientists, epidemiologists and toxicologists and others, in March of 2015 to sit down and go over all of the relevant published research that has been done on glyphosate over the years. And what they determined after looking at all of that data was that they would rank it or classify it as a probable human carcinogen. That's a 2A rating. They're not saying it's definitely going to cause you cancer. They're saying it's a probable human carcinogen based on all of the available published research. And that, of course, created a firestorm. It triggered many of the lawsuits that are now pending against Monsanto. And Monsanto just basically went crazy, lost its mind, said this International Agency for Research on Cancer was on a politically motivated agenda, and that it was looking at junk science, and that it needed to be discredited and defunded. And they've really been on the warpath for the past 2.5 years now to try to negate this finding by IARC. And it looks like they may accomplish it. I mean, we got our hands on and some internal documents from Monsanto that showed how they planned to take down this agency and to discredit this agency. And we now have Republican lawmakers in Washington, D.C. who are following that playbook and who are trying to do that very thing, specifically because of the classification of glyphosate as a probable carcinogen.
One of these efforts was around the somewhat Orwellian termed a group called the Campaign for Accuracy in Public Health Research. Who are they?
I know, right? So they formed, I refer to it as CAFR. I don't know if that's the right way to pronounce that acronym, but right. The American Chemistry Council is the umbrella body for this Campaign for Accuracy in Public Health Research, which is ironic on its face. But the specific strategy or goal of the organization is to discredit IARC. So they've put out a slew of press releases and talking points and policy papers and other efforts on social media and, you know, throughout the news cycle to try to come up with ways to make IARC look like it is not authentic and not independent and not providing good science.
And you also cite a number of other examples of how they spin the science, how Monsanto does this. And they're using things like social media. I mean, like glyphosate has its own Twitter account.
It does.
And ties to social media groups such as, I mean, I found this terrifying, Moms for GMOs and Science Moms. Are these really science moms?
Oh, right. I mean, we've seen what I document in the book and, you know, through papers that we've obtained that they've set out to do this. You're right, to sort of dominate the social media landscape with groups and individuals who appear to be authentic and independent, but whose messaging is driven by the corporate PR teams. And they've done this. They have mommy bloggers. They have, as you said, the farm wives, farm moms. Monsanto's formed a group of dietitians and nutritionists. They recruit people to post things on WebMD, for instance, that are, you know, about how safe these chemicals are and safe GMOs are. They funded a documentary film, you know, all sorts of strategies to really just try to blanket the landscape with the pro-corporate information, the propaganda.
We're talking with journalist Carrie Gillum about her book, Whitewash: The Story of a Weed Killer, Cancer, and the Corruption of Science. Now, GMOs, it's not the same issue. I mean, this is, after all, an herbicide, not a GMO, but it's very closely linked. Tell us about the connection between glyphosate and GMOs.
Right. In the 1990s, when I first started covering this industry, you know, GMOs were brand new. It was sort of the hot topic in agriculture. Genetically engineered crops, soybeans and corn and cotton, canola, sugar beets, alfalfa, that sort of thing. And what the companies want to tell you is that this is the way to feed the world and that this is the way to get crops to grow better with less water, you know, and to take up nitrogen better and to yield better and to, you know, all sorts of wonderful things, taste better, be more nutritious. You know, and I thought that sounded great. But what I learned, you know, over the years of reporting is that's not what genetically engineered crops are about. What they're about is selling herbicide. In the 90s and today, the main crop that is planted, the main genetically engineered crop that is planted and harvested around the world are crops that are genetically engineered to be sprayed directly with herbicides. That's what it's about. And that's what Roundup Ready crops are. We now also have dicamba ready or dicamba tolerant crops. Dicamba is an herbicide, and 2,4-D, which is an herbicide tolerant crops. So genetically engineered crops are very directly tied to herbicide use. It's a way for the big chemical companies to dominate the marketplace if they control the seeds and they control the chemicals that are used with the seeds, and it gives them, you know, a massive market share and pumps up those profits.
Yeah, and dicamba is hugely controversial. I mean, farmers have been saying that it's been shriveling their crops.
Well, and dicamba, the reason that our farmers are now using dicamba during these warm growing months, which they didn't do before, because dicamba is a highly volatile herbicide and it will move. It doesn't stay where you put it. And we've known that for years, decades. And farmers were always very careful about the way they used it. But glyphosate was used so much that weeds became resistant to it. Weeds have become resistant all over the United States, and farmers are struggling to find a new way to kill weeds. So Monsanto's answer to that was, we will combine glyphosate with dicamba in a new type of herbicide, and you can spray this on your new genetically modified dicamba and glyphosate tolerant crops, and life will be great. Many people warned and said, no, this isn't going to work because dicamba won't stay where you put it. Monsanto said, don't worry about it. We've made new formulations. It'll do what we want it to do. Well, it's not staying where it's supposed to stay and has been drifting and has done great damage to millions of acres of crops that aren't genetically altered to tolerate glyphosate. And so farmers are suing. There's litigation. There are all sorts of things. There's even been a murder. One farmer shot another because of this dicamba drift issue.
Now, farmers are very pressed. They often have to make a risk-benefit analysis. But you say in this book, Carrie Gilliam, you say in Whitewash that there are alternatives. I mean, of course, we know about organics as well, but many farmers can't do organics or, you know, it would just be too difficult for them. What are some of the alternatives that farmers can use or are beginning to be able to use?
Well, what I've learned from farmers, and, you know, I have to say I'm not a farmer, right? I've never had to face this challenge. But what the farmers I talk to tell me is that basically they have to go back to the days before the Roundup Ready, and they have to use more of the time-honored practices. Cover cropping is one thing. Crop rotation is another thing. Appreciating the diversity of the health of the soil and the insect population all affects how your crops grow and affects whether or not you're going to be able to deal successfully with weeds and with pest pressure. So they are returning to more strategies like that. They're not just growing corn after corn or corn after soy. You're having to introduce wheat or small grains. You're having to plant some other things perhaps that are going to act as a cover to your field. We have our USDA now recognizing that is offering some grant money to farmers to do this, some subsidies to plant cover crops, for instance. So you don't have to go organic, but you do have to put in a little more work and be more strategic, I guess, in terms of how you deal with, you know, the weed situation, which is a really important thing for farming.
And you mentioned Jack McCall before, who died of lymphoma, probably as a result of his use of glyphosate. Now his son uses dish soap mixed with some vinegar and salt, and he says it works really good. So that's an example of, you know, we can go back to the future and maybe be safer. Carrie Gilliam, your book is Whitewash, the story of a weed killer, cancer, and the corruption of science. It's really a terrific read, very comprehensive, absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much.
Nice to be with you.
Next up, we hear how one town banned pesticides. Stay tuned after the break.
I don't want a little bit, all of it, some of it. When I hear Monsanto, then I don't want none of it. I don't want resistant BT DNA injected in food seeds. So here's what I say, I don't want a little bit.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. When we think of the Alps that straddle the border of Italy and Austria, we think of idyllic meadows nestled below sun-kissed mountain peaks. Tourism is a mainstay of the economy there, but so is agriculture. The Italian side of the border is host to one of Europe's main apple-growing regions, with industrial-scale, pesticide-laden orchards taking over large swaths of the countryside. It's Big Apple, threatening both biodiversity and human health. But one town said no to Big Apple. The German-speaking Italian South Tyrol town of Malz mounted a successful campaign to ban pesticides. Philip Ackermann-Leist tells a story in his book, A Precautionary Tale. Ackermann-Leist teaches at Green Mountain College in Vermont, where he established the farm and sustainable agriculture curriculum. He's been visiting the South Tyrol region for over 30 years, ever since he managed a vineyard there in 1993. Fast forward several decades to when he was taking a student group to the area, and a friend told him about an unusual referendum.
And her name is Brigitte de Rakewiltz, and Brigitte said, well, you know, there's this referendum happening further up in the valley where they're talking about banning all pesticides. And I said, what? I can't believe it. It's one of the most beautiful places I've ever been anywhere in the world, and a place where I'd always taken student groups. And so we immediately shifted our itinerary and then took the bus and went up the valley and went to go talk to various people there about what was happening with this referendum in 2014. And ever since, it's pretty much consumed my life in a good way.
Yes, and it's an amazing story. Now, the title, A Precautionary Tale, when I first read it, I knew exactly what it referred to because I know about the precautionary principle. Tell us about the title.
Right, a precautionary tale. Obviously, we're playing off of a cautionary tale, as it's known, but you know, we're imbuing it with a little bit more meaning. And by talking about a precautionary tale, we're talking about the precautionary principle, which is a really important principle in which there's this question of where does the burden of proof lie? Does it lie upon citizens, or does it lie upon the manufacturers or the corporations or those who are responsible for a certain substance or a certain action? And, you know, frankly, it's a very predominant principle out there internationally, but not one that's been embraced in the United States, at least not by our federal government, in ways that, you know, I and others think it should be.
Yes, and we'll probably pick up that theme a little bit later, but let's talk about Mals, this one small town that banned pesticides. It's in the breadbasket of the Tyrol. Tell us about what happened when what you call Big Apple, and it has nothing to do with New York City.
Right.
When Big Apple invaded the Mals region.
Right. Well, you know, there was sort of a twin conspiracy that was going on, and that was of climate change and the positive economics of the apple industry in the South Tyrol. And, you know, climate change was making it possible, you know, as the Alps were warming and still are, you know, for apple growers to begin to plant further and further up in higher elevations and colder areas. And Mals lies at the very end of the Finchgau Valley, which is the broadest and driest valley in the Alps in this region. A really interesting place in which, you know, it's perfect for apples in many ways. And apple growers, you know, really coveted being able to put their apple orchards up there because it was a fairly dry climate, also had the cool, crisp nights, which helped the ripening, had a lot of bright sun, which helped the ripening process, and seemed really ideal in that regard. And apple growers in the South Tyrol have been making very handsome profits over the past couple of decades. If you eat an apple in Europe, you know, there's a 1 in 7 chance that you're eating an apple from the South Tyrol. And so these farmers have been making very good money, and the net profits, actually, and the euro to the dollar is about 1 to 1 right now. The net profits are about $25,000 to $40,000 per hectare, and a hectare is 2.5 acres. So when you start to think about those profits, then it's pretty extraordinary. It's not a bad way to make a living as a farmer if you can actually net that much. And so the apple growers, utilizing both the economics and also the changes in the climate, you know, started planting these plantations further and further up in the Alps. And so Mals saw that coming. And the people could see, you know, literally in the villages further down the valley, they could watch this marching upward of the apples. And they knew that with the apples came the pesticides. And that's when really the alarm calls started to be sounded.
And it's a complex story also, because it's not just the story. Big Apple is not just about pesticides. It's also about monoculture. And this story, A Precautionary Tale, sets off the contrast between the attempt to preserve agricultural biodiversity and this kind of an industrial monoculture. So tell us about that contrast.
Right. You know, and you know, as one of the folks there said, monoculture is unculture. Monoculture is unkultur. You know, that actually once you start to create an agricultural economy that's based on monoculture, then you start to lose the diversity and certainly a lot of the traditions that went along with the agriculture. In this particular area, you know, they were really pretty much self-sufficient. Most of the farms, most of the people in the area, till the 1940s, 1950s, and you know, that started to shift a little bit, and then fairly dramatically. And so whenever you do have a monoculture, then obviously you start to create scenarios where it's perfect for certain pests and diseases to move in. And when you're doing that with a fruit crop, as opposed to an annual crop, you know, many of our vegetables, for example, One thing that tends to change is you don't get the opportunity to rotate your crops, at least not for a period of decades in most cases. And so as those crops stay there, the pests and the diseases also create a habitat. And so you really, if you're not very careful, you put yourself in a scenario where you're much more dependent upon pesticides. And that's certainly what has started to happen as the landscape below Maltz and the valley down below and many regions of the South Tyrol, you know, they've just been covered now with apples. And they've lost, as a part of that process, they've lost the diversity that we know is there, you know, that goes back even to the age of the Iceman who was found nearby. So you're losing millennia of agricultural traditions based on, you know, growing various grains, growing a lot of fruits, vegetables, diversified livestock. So, you know, monoculture is, it's highly efficient, but it's not necessarily a pretty thing in ecological terms. And those ecological terms also impact the society in which they're happening as well.
And the kind of pesticide use is really kind of shocking. I mean, up to 30 pesticide applications per year, and it wasn't exactly just one pesticide. It was a lot of different pesticides. Talk about why that's a problem.
Right. You know, when we started using pesticides, actually in the 1800s predominantly in Europe and also in the United States, you know, typically we're using sulfur and copper, actually in some cases arsenic as well, but it was generally 1, 2, 3, maybe 4 pesticides. But what started to happen, and scientists and farmers realized it, was that we were building up resistance for certain pests and diseases. And so part of what started to happen was IPM came into play. IPM is the word that we've used for integrated pest management. And, you know, there's a foundation there that makes a lot of sense that, okay, we don't want to build the resistance against certain pesticides, so we want to use as many different ones as we can. But what ends up happening as a process, as part of that process, is that suddenly you're applying, you know, 10, 20, sometimes 30 different kinds of pesticides in one season. And, you know, it really starts to reach the point of absurdity. So it's hard enough to test for the negative impacts ecologically and also on human health for one pesticide. But then when we're doing this mixing, you know, and sometimes you're utilizing several pesticides in one spraying, you know, when you start to do that, you really start to realize that you get to this point of absurdity. It all was well intended in the beginning, but then it doesn't make much sense at the end. And finally, you get to the point where you literally can't test for all of the negative impacts that are happening there or potentially happening there.
And hence, not observing the precautionary principle. IPM, or integrated pest management, is supposed to lead to the lesser use of pesticides. But what you're really saying here is that these kinds of novel, inadvertent combinations are ones that could cause a whole lot of damage, even in low concentrations. What kind of damage are we talking about?
Yeah, so it's, you know, these combinative effects that we really have to worry about. We have to worry about them. They're very challenging, you know, to actually test. But we're starting to realize that there are potentially hormonal issues that come about as a result. Certainly there are issues with various kinds of cancer that we're seeing. There are reproductive issues that are beginning to be tested and noted. And, you know, and these aren't just random tests, you know, in which people are being fairly liberal in their prescriptions and thinking about their precautionary tale. You know, much of this work is being done, the research is being done and then submitted to IARC, the International Agency for Research on Cancer. And IARC is doing a review, and they tend to be fairly conservative in their reviews. But as they start to look at the carcinogenic effects of many of these pesticides, they're really raising their eyebrows and are very concerned about what's happening. And it's not even just the active ingredients that we're concerned about. And these active ingredients are the ones that, you know, are typically listed on the labels, you know, and they may comprise just, you know, 2 or 3%, 5%, maybe 10% of the chemical compound. But they're also the inactive ingredients, or the so-called inert ingredients, that comprise the rest of the solution. And those don't even have to be tested, and they're not necessarily even listed on the labels. So the precautionary principle, when you look at what's happening there and what the potential for danger is, we really have to scratch our heads and say, what are we doing to ourselves by spraying all of these different pesticides? And sometimes, they may be sprayed in small doses, but the combination of two different pesticides reacting with one another, creates certain ill effects that are even more concerning, perhaps, than what the active ingredients themselves do.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Philip Ackerman Leist about his latest book, A Precautionary Tale. One of the first people you talk about in your story is Gunter Wallnöfer. He's an organic dairy farmer. And as an organic dairy farmer, he needs to feed his cows organic hay. And he got a real shock. What happened, and how did this begin this story of how this small town Maltz ended up banning pesticides?
Right. Gunch is a really interesting farmer. He's someone who shifted to organic milk production because as he inherited his family's farm, he saw that as the only way that they could be economically viable. The conventional dairy markets, just as they are in the United States, they're really complicated, and typically the farmers make very little profit from them, especially right now. And so Gunter had shifted his family's farm operation to being organic. But then in 2009, he saw the first apple trees being planted on several sides of his farm, of his hay fields, and he started to worry at that point. But then he went to collect his hay in 2010. He knew, obviously, that his neighbor farmers had been spraying. And as he went to go collect the hay, he knew that he had to submit several different grass samples for analysis because that's part of the organic certification. You have to be able to document that your hay and all of your feed is pesticide-free. So he collected those samples, sent them in. And typically in the South Tyrol, you get three cuts of hay during one season. So this was the first cut. He submitted the samples. They came back. They tested positive for pesticides. He did it prior to the second cut. Once again, same thing. Third cut. So all of his hay that year was contaminated with pesticides. And as a result, he was told by his organic certifier, which he knew, that he had to dispose of his hay. Not only could he not feed it, he had to actually get it off of his farm because it was considered toxic at that point. And so Gunter had to get rid of his hay, and he realized that if this continued, he was going to lose his organic certification. Obviously, he couldn't cut the hay and then not actually harvest it and be buying more hay in. So he saw this as the death knell for his family's farm if something didn't change. So he went to the mayor, a young new mayor, Ulrich Veit, or Uli, as he's known there in the area. And he said, listen, Uli, this is just a travesty. Here we are. This is the kind of agriculture we're putting on all of our tourism posters. I'm doing the best I can do in terms of ecological management, and this is what I'm up against. And it's not just me. It's the other dairy farmers, conventional and organic alike. It's also the grain growers as they're getting started. Anyone who's an organic apple orchardist or organic viticulturalist, they're all facing the same thing. And so that really is where the story started to roll out.
So you really had some competing interests here, because there were people in the region who, the value of their land went up hugely because of the apple monoculture. People could make a lot of money from that and were buying up land. Gunter Wallnöfer, he found some allies, as you said, a mayor and a veterinarian. How did they begin to deal with the competing interests? How did they begin to develop a base of support in the village?
Right, that's a great question. And and they started by trying to have the difficult conversations and bringing people together to have those. To talk about pesticides and, to talk badly about apples in the South Tyrol is a bit anathema to the culture there. And so people were very hesitant to voice their concerns out in the open. So, what the town veterinarian, and others started to do was to bring people together into these public forums. And, what they started doing first was saying, what kind of a vision for agriculture do we want to have in our region? So they really started from the positive aspect at that point in time. So they provided people with the opportunity to talk about what they valued about that kind of agriculture. And as Peter Gasser, who is the veterinarian there, as he talked to various young farmers, you know, he could see that, you know, here they this was a region where they'd had livestock for at least 5 or 6 millennia. That was very well documented. And it was just ingrained in the culture. And so people really wanted to hold fast to a lot of these food traditions and agricultural traditions. So they had these conversations fairly early on. And then they started to bring in various experts to talk about the potential negative impacts of pesticides and the precautionary principle. And they did an amazing job in bringing in some of the best toxicologists in the world to come in and talk to the people, you know, in a rational and objective way about what the potential dangers were of introducing pesticides into their region. And so slowly, you know, the support really started to galvanize for them. It grew organically. These weren't necessarily people that would call themselves savvy activists, but they were people, you know, I think who were very savvy in bringing disparate people together and not polarizing the discussions from the very beginning.
They did have one principle that you say is a, you know, culturally recognized principle from this region and also in Europe, which was that, you know, they're farmers. Farmers are notoriously individualistic.
Right.
And so they declared right up front that they believe in the freedom of the individual, but it's limited by the rights of their neighbors.
Exactly. And this, you know, I worked on tracing that back with a philosopher friend there. And, you know, it seems to have its roots in Kant and the philosophy of Kant. And it's, you know, it's a very interesting principle. And even when you talk to Gunther or the veterinarian, you know, they all say this very explicitly, that people do have the right to farm as they see fit. It's as much a part of their culture as it is ours, that the farmers want to be independent. But then they also recognize, particularly in a land where the parcel sizes are fairly small, you know, many of these farmers are working on different scattered parcels that may be, you know, anywhere from 2 to 10 acres. So, you know, not as large as we're used to. So the potential negative impacts of pesticides or doing other things that, you know, might be of a negative influence for adjoining landowners, you know, the potential there is fairly high.
Now, the effect on the neighbors is not just something that they began to see was something that was happening in the present time, but also in the future, as they thought about their kids. And the women began to get involved in this village. I mean, first, you know, you had this start with one farmer, and then it moved to three people, and then it moved to a group of people, and then the women got involved. Tell us about Hollevent.
Yeah, you know, and this I think is actually probably my favorite part of the story, because here you've had predominantly males who've been guiding these discussions and holding the forums, and all folks who were doing a great job, very well intended. But, you know, what some of the women started to realize was it wasn't having much of an impact either in the media or among the regional politicians. And so, you know, there was this one scenario which really was the spark for the women. And this is when Martina Heldriegel, who was someone who grew up in Maltz and moved back after being away. She was a practicing architect in Zurich for a while. She came back to Maltz and she went to the local hairdresser, to Beatrice Ross, and she went to Beatrice, and you know, it turned out that day there was no one else in the beauty salon. So Martina said, you know, what do you think of all this? What's going on with the pesticides? And there's all this discussion, but I don't see anything happening. And Beatrice said, you know, I don't understand it either. We're talking about it in the forums, but you know, it doesn't seem to be having much of an impact. So Martina said, well, if I write a letter to the editor as a draft for other people, would you mind circulating it? And let's see if we can get it in the paper. And so she went home and worked on that right away, gave it to Beatrice, who was very well rooted in the community. And Beatrice went around asking various people if they would send this letter to the editor. And they did. And that was really the spark that started to be the game changer. So that letter appeared, and there were right around 70 folks who had signed letters to the editor in the local newspaper. And the newspaper was good enough to reprint every single one of them. And so suddenly Martina and Beatrice realized that there was power in what could be done at that point. And so they decided that they would get more women together. And there were a couple of men with them, but predominantly women. And they decided to call themselves Horlevint, which in dialect, Horlevint means stop right there or watch out. And so they gave themselves this name informally. And then they got a group of people together to actually turn bedsheets into banners. And so being a good tourist town with lots of hotels and bed and breakfast locations, they had plenty of extra sheets to go around. And so they got those sheets and very carefully stenciled these various sayings on those sheets and did this all very surreptitiously. And then they had a designated night late in July in which they decided that everyone would hang them up in the middle of the night. And so the next morning, you know, the town woke up to it was somewhere around 300 of these banners that were hung from all over. And they had the name Horlevint on them, and they were asking essentially for the mayor in the town to preserve a healthy landscape for healthy humans and, you know, also a happy and ecologically appropriate tourist location.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Philip Ackerman Leist about his latest book, A Precautionary Tale. And this mayor, I believe already by then, had done something very, very important. That is, he had allowed or changed the law in the town, allowing for a binding referendum by the population. Tell us about that referendum and how that was so critical to bringing this struggle forward. And then what happened to it?
So Uli, the mayor, Ulrich Veit, had worked in Switzerland, I believe, for about 14 years. And Switzerland has an amazing direct democracy approach to so much of what they do. And Uli had picked up on that while he was working there. So one of the first things that he did when he became mayor was very quietly worked with the town council to adopt this proposal that any referendum that was held and approved by the public would be binding. That is, that the town council had to take it up. It didn't prescribe what the town council would do, but the town council did have to deal with it. And so this was passed, and Uli was very savvy. He knew that this might come into play a little bit later. And sure enough, as more and more people became very concerned about what was happening, they created an advocacy committee. They very wisely appointed the town pharmacist, i.e. the town chemist, as the spokesperson. And what better person to have as a spokesperson than someone who deals with these minute doses, in their prescriptions and really understands that it's the dose that makes the poison. So having this particular pharmacist, Johannes Unterpertinger, having him as the spokesperson really made an enormous difference. And so this advocacy committee started to push forward this idea that there should be a public referendum, and that public referendum at the beginning, the discussion was the public referendum would be to ban pesticides. But part of what happened by virtue of the women stepping into the process with Horlevint is that they had one beekeeper there, Pia Oswald, who just has also this amazing self-sufficient homestead that she's created. And Pia very wisely said, let's create a positive campaign, not a negative one. Let's don't talk about banning pesticides. Let's not use the words no, not, never, ban. Instead, let's be positive about it. So in the end, the referendum that came forward was for a pesticide-free malts and a pesticide-free future. So suddenly it had this glimmer of sunshine in it, a glimmer of hope, and it wasn't something that was set up to polarize the community as well in the same kind of way that a ban on pesticides per se would do.
Now, we haven't yet talked about the huge barriers that were put into place by Big Apple and by the provincial government and the powers that be. Tell us a little bit about that, and we don't have a time to go into it into great detail, but there was a whole lot of pushback. Tell us about that pushback and how the town finally was able to prevail.
Yeah, the irony was that at the beginning, this seemed like such a homegrown campaign, by a small group of individuals, a small town sort of isolated up in the upper area of the Finchgal Valley, that, you know, it wasn't taken seriously at first, you know, by the apple cooperatives who were really dominating so much of this, or by the South Tyrolean Farmers Association, or by the regional government. They, you know, they really just blew it off at the beginning. But by the time the maltsters, the people of malts, had come together, you know, they had galvanized and moved forward so quickly that there really wasn't time, you know, for the pushback, you know, to be as effective as it might have been. So the South Tyrolean government officials and others did everything they could to forestall the referendum so that it might not take place. There was a media campaign that was started by the Farmers Association, which was, you know, really pleading the case for farmers to be able to make their living in the ways that they needed to, and not to be attacked. But you know, the maltsters were very savvy in their responses in all of this, and they would invite the provincial officials and apple cooperatives and others to come forward in public and talk about, you know, what their concerns were. But, you know, it really was, a very dramatic turnaround. Nobody really believed that the people of Maltz could pull this off. But, you know, not only did they pull it off, but they became a beacon at the international level as well, which is really extraordinary.
Say a little bit more about that.
Yeah, you know, so once the referendum did pass, and everyone was wondering what might happen. This was in, the referendum went for 2 weeks. They haven't had an open polling period. They wanted to make sure that people could vote in whatever way was most convenient for them during that 2 week polling period. Unlike what happens in the United States, the mayor wasn't allowed to talk about it. The people of the town council weren't allowed to talk about it. You know, there was this fairly quiet voting period, although there were sunflowers that appeared, you know, throughout various parts of the village at this point in time. There were painted wooden sunflowers that said yes, that appeared, and sunflowers floating in fountains, and sunflowers that appeared suddenly on the pavement in various villages. You know, but basically, people weren't allowed to do a lot of demonstrating or talking at this point. And so then in September, when the votes went to be counted, 3/4 of the population voted in favor of a pesticide-free future, which was just extraordinary. And it actually reflected almost within a percentage point or two the results of the polls that the veterinarian and other folks in the environmental groups had done about a year prior, trying to determine how many people might support this. And so people throughout Europe recognized immediately what had happened and how significant it was. So now at this point in time, Europe has a pesticide-free village campaign, which is modeled after the successes of Maltz. The Pesticide Action Network of Europe came to Maltz and had their annual General Assembly last May. They've been recognized by people such as Vandana Shiva in India, and I was actually fortunate enough back in October to be present at a ceremony where the mayor of Maltz, Uli, came together with Vandana Shiva and also the governor of Sikkim, the prime minister of Sikkim in India, which is the world's first organic state. So suddenly, Maltz is a beacon of what can be done as small communities get together and really savvily move their way forward and try to chart their own future instead of having it dictated by others.
And Vandana Shiva, we should say, does provide the foreword to your book, A Precautionary Tale, How One Small Town Banned Pesticides, Preserved Its Food Heritage, and Inspired a Movement. It's a terrific book. There is so, so much more in the book. It's almost a guide, really, to communities on how to do the same thing. Very, very impressed with both the residents of the town and by your writing, his beautiful writing. Philip Ackerman Leist, thanks so much for talking with us here.
Thank you so much, Francesca. It's really been a pleasure.
Philip Ackerman Leist is the author of Rebuilding the Food Shed and Up Tunkett Road. He's a professor at Green Mountain College in Vermont. Read an excerpt from his book, A Precautionary Tale, at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.